It's such a pleasure to welcome onto the show the legendary Marty Wilde. It's so great to speak with you today.
Lovely to speak to you, Sue.
Now, many fans will be queuing up to see and hear you at the Marty Wilde Rock and Roll Show that's on tour. And as you really are one of the original and leading British rock and roll singers. Now, it must have been such a phenomenal time for music. How did it feel to be involved at the start of rock and roll?
Well, at the time, I think in a funny kind of way, you know, sometimes things happen to you in your life which you're not really aware of at the time, but I think it was different for me. I was very aware that the rock and roll was going to be a big force, that it would be a big musical force, and that it would, I felt that it had a future, a longevity, and you know, it knocked me for six, because it was a huge musical revolution when it came in, and you know, there was nothing like it before. There's nothing, there's never been a musical revolution like that since. And it affected and influenced every group and every singer for generations after when it first came in. So it was very special, and I think I was very aware of it, very aware.
And wasn't it, like you said, it's never been repeated, has it?
No.
I mean, very often when people talk about the birth of rock and roll, they talk about Bill Haley and the Comets, and Rock Around the Clock, I believe, is one of your personal favourites, along with Summertime Blues by Eddie Cochran. What was it about those particular songs that influenced you, and what is it about rock and roll that really got into your system?
Well, as much as anything, it's like youngsters of today. I mean, they dance to a rhythm, you know, they want to hear a really good rhythm, and that was the same with, that was the impact of rock and roll, really. There was blues mixed with country western. It was kind of a fusion of the two musics together. But then you had this phenomenal beat, and it was the first time I'd ever heard a beat like it. I mean, people in America had been listening to the blues for years, so they had a head start on us. But I'd never really heard the blues quite like that, and I'd never heard this kind of rhythm. So the whole thing, when you put it into one ginormous package, was a huge influence, and very exciting, very, very exciting. And both those tracks, Rock Around the Clock or Summertime Blues, either, you know, the Bill Haley track or the Eddie Cochran track, have both got very, very good rhythm sounds to them.
They're phenomenal, aren't they? I absolutely love those songs. Always get you up on the dance floor, guaranteed, isn't it? Now, I mean, many of your fans have described you as sexy and cool. Do you think the American rock and roll artists influenced that in some way?
Oh, yeah, America. I mean, we've always been influenced by America. We always will be. It's just a natural, thing that happens. And I think, you know, we were no different. I mean, the music was coming from America. It kicked off there. As I say, it was a fusion of blues, you know, rhythm and blues and country western music. So I think, you know, I mean, and obviously you based yourself on you. I was very influenced by Elvis and Buddy Holly and Eddie and Jerry Lee Lewis, you know, those kind of people. Mm-hmm. So as the youngsters are today, you know, they, you know, Black Eyed Peas are going to have people that, they must have influenced a lot of young people, I would think, in this country. Yes. And a lot of the artists in America will still have that hold on us to a certain extent. And why not? You know, as long as they're great artists, like we had. You know, we had the Elvises and the other, you know, the other people like Eddie Cochran. And so, you know, it's a natural thing. I think America will always be a big influence in our music, but not necessarily... you know, it won't always be like the be-all and end-all. I mean, when the Beatles came along, it reverted in a way. It kind of changed around, and we were our charts were filled with our own music, with the odd American track. But and that probably happens to a certain extent at the moment. You know, obviously, you know, we will always be. British people will always be influenced by American artists, always.
Yes, yeah, well, there's a lot of great influences there, isn't there?
Yeah.
And I mean, talking of Bill Haley and Elvis, as we were, they've both had hits with songs connected with Hound Dogs. And I believe you set up a band called Reg and the Hound Dogs. Did you always dream of being a rock and roll star, and where did you ideally want to perform?
I always dreamed, I think once I heard rock and roll, I'd always wanted to be a pop star. I always dreamed, when I was 15... I dreamt, you know, I used to dream that, you know, like most youngsters do, and dream about being a, you know, a big star. But it was unusual in those days, because there weren't so many of those kind of stars around. And when skiffle came in first, I used to listen to skiffle and I could play guitar, so that was obviously an influence. But then rock and roll was the next big influence, and that really changed things. So, I wanted to be a rock and roll star. There's no question about that. Where I'd like to have played, I didn't care where I played. I just would have played anywhere where I was singing and playing my music.
Yeah, just in your blood already.
Yep.
I mean, many who aspire to be a rock and roll artist long for a guitar. You're just talking about instruments there. And I know many fans will know of Carl Perkins, who literally made his own because he had so little money when starting out.
Yep.
But I believe the instrument you first played on was a ukulele. Was this a good instrument to get you ready for the guitar? And when did you make the transition?
Yes, it was. It was a ukulele. I mean, thank goodness the schools, if any teachers are listening out there, the teachers are starting to introduce in a lot of schools ukulele playing. It's a gift. That is a gift to a child. That is as important as any lesson you could give that child, because the influence of music and the love of music is something the government hopefully will never be able to tax. And it's something that's free, and it's one of the most, it's the closest, it's my religion. I don't have a religion, so music is one of the few things that can raise the hairs on my arms and also make me cry and make me happy. So it's very, very influential form of influence, artistic and creative influence in your life. So bring ukuleles, more and more of them to the youngsters. And also, it's easy, the transition from playing a ukulele over to a guitar is not difficult, because it's virtually the same tuning. And the first few chords, like a G and a C and a D, are the same on a guitar, so you've got a head start once you've learned to play the ukulele. For me, the transition was from skiffle to rock and roll. It was just a question then of listening to a lot more blues, which I used to. I was lucky to have someone that was always giving me blues records to listen to when I was a youngster. So that influence made me want to go on and obviously be a rock and roll singer. But it also made me want to move on and to learn to play the chords. To play chords is a gift. It's an absolute gift, because you can be alone on an island with no one around. If you've got a guitar or ukulele, you're never alone.
That's wonderful, isn't it? I mean, like you're saying, it's sort of almost like you said, a spiritual experience or religious, because it just, you know, you're not thinking the words, but the music just sort of comes to you. Which is really, that's great. It's great to know how to start on these things, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, many singers and musicians also know that you need a big break, and they form a group quite early. I believe it was by forming a group by yourself that, you know, you got yourself noticed. Tell us about that.
I had some school friends, and when skiffle first came in, which was a guitar sort of based, and they didn't have a real bass player in those days in that kind of skiffle sound. They had a guy standing on a tea chest with a piece of string through it and a kind of a pole, and they used to bend the pole back and get some kind of a thump out of it. So we were playing acoustic guitars with this crazy bass, but that was the sound of the time. And so we formed this group. There were school friends, most of them were at my school. And off we went. We started to play, and the public must have liked us, you know, pretty immediately, really, because we started to pick up bookings, and they used to pay us. I mean, we were paid extremely low money. We would pay something like, you know, we get the equivalent today of about, I don't know, about £2 coins and each, you know, like £2 coins each for one show. So you went home with £2 in your pocket, but it wasn't much. But the joy that you had from doing it was immeasurable. And so that's how it started. You know, didn't get much money. Wasn't interested. I'm interested in money in making, of course, to a certain extent, but that's never been my priority. My priority is making music.
Yeah, I think the rest comes after that, doesn't it? You do something that you really love.
Yes.
I mean, did you expect the news of the band to spread quite so rapidly? Was that quite a surprise to you, or were you just enjoying it so much that it just came about?
Yeah, I never thought at the time. I just never thought we were getting one booking after another. We started off playing little local charity days, hospitals, places like that. And then they started to they asked us to play in cinemas in the break in between the films. Sometimes it would be like 20 minutes. So they'd ask us to play for about 10 minutes. And we started to get booked at the Granadas, which were, it was a big circuit, a film, showing circuit in the south and all over the country. So we used to, mostly in Kent, around about that area, we would be playing. And it happened very quickly. I never thought, I just didn't realize how quick it would happen. But there was the people that followed us, of course, had influences, some of them, and some of them would tell other people up in London. You see, you had to be a star in London, really, to make it. And gradually, I was drawn there. We did an amateur show at the Hammersmith Palais. We did an amateur show where we came very high. We came third. But the two people in front of us were already big, well-established stars. So for some little amateur group, to do that, to come third against these big stars, was quite something. And the word got around again. So eventually, I ended up singing in London. It's this time they wanted me on my own. And they booked me 2 weeks' work. And the last week was at the Condor Club in Soho. And that's where I got Larry Parnes, who was like the Simon Cowell of his day. He heard me and signed me up. That was it.
And the rest is history, as they say.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're talking about getting lowly pay. Was it £1 a night plus a bowl of spaghetti?
It was. Exactly that.
Oh, that's the way you have to start.
I used to catch the last bus home. I think it was about 1 o'clock in the morning. So I had to make sure that I could get out of this club in time and to catch that last bus, otherwise I'd have had a hell of a... It was good fun, though.
Yeah, it sounds a laugh, actually. But, I mean, you're talking about Larry Parnes there, who was Tommy Steele's manager, one of the most, powerful managers in the UK. He encouraged his protégés to change their name, as he did with Billy Fury and the like. Did he help you to form the Wildcats at that time?
Well, he changed my name. We just auditioned for musicians, and then I had many different kind of Wildcats. There was, musicians were coming and going because sometimes they wouldn't really work out, and gradually groups change anyway. And so eventually I got a group that were really hot. And so that was how the Wildcats came to be formed.
I see. Now, of course, another breakthrough for the UK was people being able to watch on television artists they'd only been able to hear on the radio. And I understand the legendary Jack Good quickly snapped you up to appear on his show, Oh Boy. Did you feel that show captured the atmosphere of rock and roll, and what would you say you learnt the most from that show?
I think the Oh Boy show was the greatest pop show I think there's ever been. I don't think there's been a better one. Because it was, if you could imagine today, people like Robbie Williams take some of the greatest rappers, get some of the greatest street cred young people, get people, or just one Adele, get other people, get as many huge stars and up-and-coming stars and people that are high in the charts, get them all together, being paid hardly anything at all, but get them on that show singing live. Not miming, singing live. And it hit the nation. And it was beautifully lit. It was done in a very theatrical sense. It wasn't done... In fact, later on in my life, I had the pleasure of going to America to work on the Dick Clark show. Dick Clark had a TV show out there, which was huge. One of the biggest influences in rock and roll that America had. Our show walked all over it. Our show was 100 times better. We were organized, we were beautifully lit, and the pace of the show was thought about, the songs were handpicked. So it really was. It was a standout show, Even to this day, you can look at that show, and there aren't many copies of it left, but you can look at it and think, yeah, that was thought about. Because previously to that, there had not been a show like it. There'd never been that kind of thought put into a production. And the influences, of course, have stayed with me, because Jack Good was the producer of that show, and was a genius, and he influenced people like Cliff Richard, me, Marty, Billy Fury, everybody. You name anyone that came into his, and obviously very much Gene Vincent and Eddie Cochran. He influenced them greatly.
First of all, it's kind, really, isn't it? It's quite amazing, isn't it? The sort of, you know, power of that show that's just influenced everybody, as you were saying. But, of course, so many singers in the business sing your praises, and Robert Plant's been quoted as saying Marty Wilde was possibly one of the two or three singers in the UK who actually could capture the American art. How do you think you managed to bring that quality to a British audience?
I don't know, really. I mean, I'm a fussy sort of a guy. I mean, things to me are either right or they're wrong. There's no half measures. So when I used to try to sing or do things, I always wanted it to be the best. It wasn't always the best, of course, you know, but you aim for that, you try. So I was a fussy devil, and I wouldn't let things go. I was listening all the time to influences such as the Eddie Cochrans and the Hollies and Jerry Lee Lewis and Elvis. And I tried to obviously imitate that kind of feel that they had. And I must have got it a little bit better than the others. Also, I was kind of a laid-back cat. You know, I wasn't a pushy sort of a guy. And I just used to do it in my own way. So, I was just me. And I thought, luckily, my persona worked with the public.
Certainly did. I mean, you is all you can be, and you was perfect. But, I mean, it's always been important to make it in the charts, hasn't it? Particularly at that time. How long did it take for you to really get the breakthrough you were happy with?
It took quite a time, actually. I had, it would have been over a year and a half, I would have thought. I had several records released, which I thought were poor. I didn't like the records. And the first record which went into the charts was Endless Sleep. And I was really pleased, and I still am to this day, with that record. It was okay, you know, it worked. The previous records I wasn't particularly mad on. And subsequently, I've had a few, you know, one doesn't like all your records at all. I mean, some of them I think I don't like at all. But some I do. Some of the music I made wasn't bad. Bad Boy and Tomorrow's Clown and things like that, you know, were pretty good tracks, so, you know, I'm still pleased when I hear them. But Endless Sleep was the first breakthrough, and you do need to be in the charts. It's absolutely essential. You can make it other ways, I suppose, just by, you know, just by being really brilliant and going around the country. But if you're that good, I think you will get into the charts.
Yes, it's all about the record sales particularly, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Now, I mean, as well as dominating in the 50s, in which you co-wrote for many others, but in latter years, including your daughter, Kim Wilde, you've also enjoyed success as a songwriter in the 1960s and 70s, where you wrote Lulu's I'm a Tiger and the early status quo hit Ice in the Sun. Did you enjoy that process?
Yeah, I've always enjoyed writing for other people, always. And if people have success with my songs, you know, great. I've never felt jealous, you know. And, I mean, I had one thing where I was writing a song, and I had the title. It was called Love Me, Love My Dog. And it was kind of a little, sort of a semi-country, sort of a very 70s sort of feel type song. And the guy I was writing it with copied my recording, with my permission, of course, and he had a huge hit with it, and I never once felt jealous of Peter, because Peter Shelley had a hit with it. I was just very pleased and happy for Peter, and he was a co-writer, so we had a hit. So I've never, and same with Kim, I was never jealous of my children, and I mean, because that can happen. You know, you can get people, you know, that get jealous of their in-family things. I've never been jealous of anyone who had a hit with my songs. I mean, that's great. Good luck to them.
No, it's fantastic to be so sort of magnanimous about that. But of course, you also, if I'm right, you wrote with Ronnie Scott, but that was under a pseudonym.
Yes.
Why did you choose Sudanism?
Because at that point in time, people put me, you know, we're inclined to put people in boxes. So you look at someone on TV and you think, I like them or I don't like them. Mm-hmm. And you look at them and you might look at, I don't know, like a politician, for example, mm-hmm. and say, I don't like him. I would imagine he's unintelligent. He doesn't like me. Sorry, he wouldn't. He and I would not get on. He doesn't like this. He doesn't like that. I know he doesn't. And yes. You form these opinions. You put them in a box.
Yeah.
And so they had that. People had a very strong opinion of me. I'm sure they did in those days. I was a rock and roll singer, and I'd had my career. You know, my career was in the 50s, and it was now. You know, it was now in the 70s and then 80s. So I thought, right, you know, I'm going to put an end to that. no one's going to know. And, of course, I had numerous hits, you know, under that name, so which was, I think it was Freya Manston I used to go under.
Yes.
So no one would have guessed that Freya Manston was Marty Wilde.
Certainly not. No, you couldn't get more different, could you? But, I mean, it's ridiculous to even think of putting you in a box because you're such an all-round performer. Because as well as... your wonderful songwriting and performing. You've also appeared in a musical as well as Conran Birdie in Bye Bye Birdie.
Yes, I was.
You obviously, I believe, another one of your favourite musicals is like mine, West Side Story. Would you like to star in another musical?
Not now. No, I wouldn't. No. Mm. No. But West Side Story was one of the first shows I ever saw with my wife when we first got married. One of the a friend we knew who was a writer, a newspaper writer, got us tickets to see West Side Story in the West End. I remember we were sort of really, it was a very emotional ending. We were very moved, extremely moved. Mm-hmm. And that has remained to this very day. It's still my favourite musical.
Love it.
I think. I mean, I love Sound of Music is another one, which I think the songs are phenomenal. Obviously,
oh, yes.
But West Side was the technical for me. Was Bernstein at his very best and very creative. And
yes,
wonderful.
Definitely Bernstein, Jerome Robbins choreography, all the stars in that Cheetah Rivera. Just amazing, isn't it?
Yes.
And I mean, talking about musicals, who is it? Tim Rice has been quoted as saying some wonderful things.
Really?
Have you ever met Tim Rice? And would you like to work together? Or?
Yeah, well, I know Tim well. Mm-hmm. Tim we're both songwriters, and we both belong to a society of songwriters called the SODS, which is Songwriters of Distinction. So it's a bit of a cheeky name, but I suppose I'll meet Tim maybe two or three times a year, and we'll talk briefly or whatever. But he's always been. He's one of those, he's a rare bird in a way, because he is the most natural, warm, big-hearted, loving man that you could meet. He's fantastic. He's just really, and so he is full of humility. I mean, this man's lyrics are wonderful, and he's always done, you know, some of the best work I've ever heard any lyric writer do, or as good as anybody. But he's very humble, and he just is a lovely man, so... Yeah, working with Tim Rice would be a gift, and he is a friend. He's a lovely man.
Yeah, it's lovely to hear, isn't it, that everyone's, you know, the same off, you know, away from the public persona, if you like. Now, of course, we were talking about, you know, West Side Story a moment ago, which enjoyed its 50th anniversary, and it wasn't not that long ago that you enjoyed yours. I mean, it's really quite phenomenal in the age that we're living in, that artists come and go, but it's such a massive achievement that you've been in the business over 50 years. Did you envisage that? Did you still think you would be playing, and do you have any plans to retire?
I always thought rock and roll would last. I felt it was such an impact that it would last. It would send out ripples right the way around the world that would reverberate. Those ripples would reverberate for years and years. So I've always had faith in rock and roll and its influences. And giving up, no, I could. I would like to, if possible, because I'm not the youngest man anymore that I used to be. So I would like to continue as long as I physically can. I'd like to, you know, I would just like to carry on. And I just like people to say, well, what was rock and roll? You know, what you know, give me an inkling of what it was like in those days. And if I can purvey that across to the audience, until I'm in my 90s, I should be very happy.
Well, I certainly hope you do. And it's great because, you know, a new generation, as well as people who've grown up in the 50s, are going to be able to enjoy that, because you're going to be bringing your show, Marty Wilde Rock and Roll Party, on tour. And you'll be joined when you come to the New Victoria Theatre in Woking on the 12th of October by two special guests, John Layton and Eden Kane. Now, I'm guessing you know each other of old.
Well, unfortunately, John Layton is out of the show, unfortunately. A very late problem. He's had to have an emergency operation.
Sorry to hear that.
A few days ago, about 3 or 4 days ago. So you're one of the first outside of our circle to hear that. We've replaced him with another great artist called Mike Berry. So Berry will be, you know, he's a big Buddy Holly man, and he's going to be on the show to replace him. But Eden Kane and Mike, and of course Johnny Layton, I've known them all for years, and particularly Johnny Layton and Eden Kane. They're very dear friends. So I just hope that John is better soon. It's going to take a little time for him to get better, but he'll be on the road to recovery, I'm sure.
Well, we certainly hope so, and we wish him well from myself and Brooklyn's Radio. Now, I hope audiences on tour can look forward to all your greatest hits like Teenager in Love, Sea of Love, and End of Sleep. But will you be throwing in some songs from one of your more newly released albums, Born to Rock and Roll?
No, most of the material will be all hit-based, hits flying all over the place, I would think. I know I do nearly all of mine, so... you know, that's what we've always done them. But we're doing a lot of new material as well, not just my hits. So it's quite an extensive show. It's a great show. We've been rehearsing. Was rehearsing yesterday actually, all day, and we're starting to get the show into shape before it goes. And we've got more rehearsals coming up, and it will be a great show. And it's one of the last chances, really. I mean, the chances of getting of us all together like this is getting slimmer and slimmer because of age, really, as much as anything, and because, you know, at that time of life, you know, things come in that health problems come in, like John Layton, you know, had a problem, they had to have it rectified, and also, you know, it's just an age thing, so. It's one of the few last chances that people will get to see us, I think, playing together and singing together like this.
Yeah.
So Roxanne, my daughter, Roxanne Wilde's on the show as well.
Oh, lovely. Oh, fantastic. Well, I know you're just going to carry on playing for years. And just a question I was going to ask, out of all the iconic hits you've made, if you really had to pick one song that you could sing, what would it be and why?
Probably Bad Boy, because Bad Boy was my first self-penned hit. And it was a song that made me realise that I could actually write hit songs. Bad Boy, definitely.
Fantastic. Well, we look forward to hearing that on the night, on the 12th of October, that you're going to be at New Victoria. And I know it's a show that's going to get us all rocking and rolling. It sounds absolutely fantastic. So it just remains for me to thank you so much for sparing the time to speak with me today, Marty.
My pleasure.
And I hope the tour goes absolutely brilliantly.
Thank you very much, Sue.
Thank you. And that was the legendary Marty Wilde, who'll be on tour with his show, Marty Wilde Rock and Roll Party. Brooklyn's Radio.